Of course, getting a dog can make a youngster blissfully happy. But for Iowa high school student Tyler Gertz, his pooch is much more than a pet. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we learn about the first service dog to run cross-country in Iowa. Also today, an Iowa view of the Planned Parenthood controversy. We meet a winner of this year's Grinnell Prize. We learn how digital textbook data can help predict student outcomes, how being a cop on a bike changes patrols, and how oats are not only good for fueling our bodies, oats can also provide environment-friendly fuel for power plants. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week about news of the week. Well, this week, another chapter in the controversy over Planned Parenthood. A controversy that started with a series of videos released by an anti-abortion organization that purportedly show Planned Parenthood officials discussing the sale of tissue samples from aborted fetuses. On Tuesday of this week, the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Cecile Richards, testified before Congress. She said the videos falsely portray her organization's participation in life-saving scientific research, calling the videos doctored, the accusations outrageous, and categorically untrue. Abortion foes say the recordings show a criminal conspiracy to make money off of aborted baby parts. This is a controversy also playing out here in Iowa, where Governor Branstad has been under pressure from Iowa Republicans in the House and Senate to eliminate all government funding for Planned Parenthood, including programs that pay for non-abortion services. Bill Petrosky is with us, State House reporter for the Des Moines Register. Bill, a little explanation here about what's going on. Good day to you.
Well, thanks a lot, Ben. Oh, this is just really kind of an extraordinary situation because within his own party, Governor Branstad is taking a lot of pressure. There's not just a small group of Republicans. About 10 Republicans met with him about this issue and strongly urged him to defund Planned Parenthood, but I'm told there are quite a few others. 40 Republican legislators urged Attorney General Miller to investigate Planned Parenthood. The Republican Central Committee, State Central Committee of Iowa, voted about a week ago or so to defund Planned Parenthood, and the Family Leader, which is an influential Christian conservative group, they are very, very strongly pushing this, and they've actually produced a video that shows Governor Branstad pledging in 2010 to defund Planned Parenthood, and they're saying, we want you to follow through on that promise.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick up on several things that you said, but to be clear, does government money fund any abortions here in Iowa?
I'm told there has been no taxpayer funding of abortions in Iowa, any abortions in Iowa, for at least 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, the part of Planned Parenthood that takes care of this region, says it does not distribute any fetal tissue for research. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so some Iowa Republicans, a good number of them, asking the governor to do this, to defund Planned Parenthood. His response?
And what he says is he's talked with the Attorney General's office, and he says that the Attorney General has told him that they cannot defund Parenthood. Basically, what he's saying is that the Attorney General has notified him that unless the state has some reasons on if Planned Parenthood has not violated their responsibilities under the grants that they've received from the state, that the state can't take any action to defund them.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Family Leader, this conservative,
that's right,
Christian conservative group, wanting to take up on the governor up on a pledge that he purportedly made several years ago.
He didn't just purportedly made it. He actually made
it. He did make it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He did say that, and there's a video of him on Iowa Public Television actually making that pledge. So there's no question about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what does Branstad do in reaction to that pledge?
Well, basically what the governor is saying is, look, I can't do something that's illegal. You know, the governor did support the Iowa Board of Medicine when it tried to stop the use of telemedicine for abortions, these so-called webcam abortions. And the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And he said, hey, I've already, you know, gone to court on one of these types of issues, and I don't want to go to court again and lose. But he has said, hey, look, I'll look at what we can do in the future. And I think there's going to be a big fight in the upcoming legislative session over this issue. And we could even see a delay in the end of this session over this issue. Democrats are clearly saying they won't go along with defunding Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. Given the explanation that you've given us here, what type of legislation could possibly be introduced by Republicans here?
Well, I think what they will do is simply say something to the effect that no government money can go to Planned Parenthood for grants or anything like that. Right now, there is government money in Iowa. About $2.7 million in public money is going to Planned Parenthood of Central Iowa, but there is no specific line item in the state budget for Planned Parenthood. This is just money that happens to be distributed in the form of grants, as I understand it. But the legislature could specifically, you know, pass a bill that says we don't want a dime of state money or federal money channeled through Iowa government channels to go to Planned Parenthood. And I think that's probably what you would see. And we've already got Senate Majority Leader Gronstahl saying he won't go along with that. He's saying that, hey, look, Family Planning Services, one of the things that they do is that they do prevent pregnancies. And his argument is, the bottom line is that by preventing pregnancies, you will prevent additional abortions.
Mm-hmm. You've spoken with Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. What is their perspective here?
Oh, well, you know, they point out, hey, look, our job is providing high-quality health care, education, family planning services to men and women no matter what. And they strongly disagree with, you know, the characterization and by the pro-life people and these videos. And they feel that, you know, that they're a victim of a smear campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Campaign.
Bob Vanderplaats, the head of the Family Leader, has named a fraud case in his argument to defund Planned Parenthood. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, basically, what the situation is that there's a woman named Sue Thayer who has formerly worked for Planned Parenthood, and she has an open court case that's still pending. And basically, she's alleging that Planned Parenthood of the Heartland scammed state and federal taxpayers in terms of their operation of their Medicaid contract. And Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, their response is that this is just not the case. They believe it's an ongoing lawsuit with a disgruntled employee, and they strongly deny all of these allegations. They've said, hey, we don't have any other statement on this case, and it's still being litigated.
Mm-hmm. And this is a separate controversy, litigation not having anything to do and starting well before the series of videos released by this anti-abortion organization.
That's correct. And we have talked with the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals, and they say that there is an open case by the state's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in relation to this, but they said essentially there's no investigative work being done on at this time, and they're going to monitor what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Here we have something playing out on a national level, and then here playing out on this level as well. Speaking in political terms, because we are in an election cycle to a mm-hmm. general election coming up, is this likely to color, for instance, the 2016 presidential race, the candidates as they come through Iowa?
Well, sure. We're already hearing a lot of the presidential candidates talk about this. I just covered Ben Carson this morning. He did not mention this, but I know I've heard Jindal mention it. I've heard Santorum mention it. There's been a number of Republican candidates that have been talking about this issue. It's a big deal. But you are also going to see this very likely, if this thing is not decided, you're going to see this come up in 2016 legislative races in Iowa. I was just in Council Bluffs last weekend for covering Governor Kasich, Ohio Governor Kasich, who spoke at a fundraiser for State Representative Marianne Hennussen. I talked with some of the Republicans there, and they said, hey, we're going to use this against Senator Gronstahl when he runs again. He's up for re-election next fall. of 2016, they said, we're going to try to use this against him. Now, Senator Gronstall is pretty popular, and I think his chances are probably pretty good for re-election. But you will, if this issue is not resolved by the end of the legislative session, I'm sure you'll see it come up, especially kind of in a targeted manner, and particularly in some districts where this type of thing could really become a volatile issue.
It's clear that Christian conservatives have a view of Planned Parenthood and want to defund it, Bill. But do we know how Iowans at large, in general, feel about Planned Parenthood?
Well, you know, I think there are polls all over the place on this. I've seen polls strongly indicating both sides of this. You know, I think I've seen several polls in the last week saying that, in general, the American public supports Planned Parenthood. I think the people who are the Christian conservatives will tell you that when they've done surveys and when people have seen these videos, that people have reacted very negatively towards Planned Parenthood. I think that's one of the things that you're going to continue to hear.
Okay, Bill Petrosky, State House reporter for the Des Moines Register, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a handful of short news conversations to end the week. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Grinnell College announced the winners of its Innovator for Social Justice Prize. It's known simply as the Grinnell Prize. It's a $100,000 award honoring young innovators in social justice. And let's talk with one of this year's two winners. Maria Vertkin is founder of Found in Translation. We're talking to her in Boston. Hello, Maria, and congratulations.
Hello, thank you so much.
What is Found in Translation?
Found in Translation is a nonprofit that trains low-income bilingual women as medical interpreters and connect them to well-paying jobs in the medical interpreting field. So they get to use their language skills to climb out of poverty.
Mm-hmm. So how did this start? How did you get the idea? You had sort of a mismatch. You had people looking for ways their language could be their second language, in their native language could be used, and you found a need for it.
That's right. Yeah, I think part of it began with my own life story. I'm an immigrant. And there have been many, many, many times when language has been very helpful to me. And there have been other times where being bilingual was definitely a barrier. And, you know, I faced discrimination because of being from somewhere else, being different. And when I ended up working as a social worker, working with young adults, working with families, a lot of them were facing the same thing. And a lot of them didn't recognize that their own bilingualism is an asset. Mm-hmm. And I started to think, you know, what can they do with this skill set, with being bilingual, that makes money, that can help them to improve their lives permanently. And medical interpreting just seemed like a really good idea. When I first discovered this profession, something I really liked is that the training is fairly short. You don't need a master's degree to do it. Your master's degree is your bilingual knowledge. It's not a male-dominated profession, and you can get into jobs that pay $20, $30, $40 an hour.
Mm-hmm. So help us understand what these people will do in a medical situation as interpreters.
So as interpreters, a Found in Translation graduate will be working at a hospital or a clinic where there will be a provider, like a doctor or a nurse, who doesn't speak the language of the patient, and a patient who speaks another language that's not English. And the interpreter speaks both those languages and can relay the message back and forth. And they're trained in medical terminology, in anatomy and physiology, in the ethics of the profession to do a good job.
Mm-hmm. And there's a real need here, and a growing need.
Yes, the need is huge. It's actually, by some estimates, it's the fourth fastest growing field in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Help us understand a little bit of the scope of the immigrant homeless problem. You're speaking to us from Boston. Boston and other large cities are encountering a lot of homeless immigrants.
Yeah, it's a very big problem, and it's a systemic problem. It just so happens that the way poverty works in the U.S., and actually in a lot of places, is that it affects certain types of people more than others, and we tend to concentrate minorities, ethnic minorities, racial minorities, immigrants, women, in low-income communities, and it's actually one of the things that really got me thinking about this problem, seeing as a social worker. Everyone comes from such a different, everyone has such a different story. Everyone comes from different walks of life. But something that a lot of them had in common was that disproportionately there were women, there were people of color, there were immigrants, they were from another country. And on one hand, it's injustice, it's systemic, it's disturbing. On the other hand, there's an opportunity there, and that's that because we concentrate poverty, we concentrate minorities in poverty, we also concentrate linguistic talent in those communities. And then those communities can use that asset to improve their situation.
I understand that your organization, Found in Translation, focuses solely on women. Why?
We focus on women because we want to have the biggest impact. And our goal is to reduce disparities across race, ethnicity, cultural background, and gender. There's a big gender inequality in the workforce, and we want to be able to address that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this medical interpretation model that you've worked on here, that you've founded, could be replicated in other industries? Are there other areas where interpreters are needed and these native languages would come in useful?
Actually, yes. A lot of our graduates, especially the ones that speak a more unusual language, work not just in medical settings, but also in legal settings. In community settings, they might work in written translation in addition to interpreting, which is spoken. And there's a need everywhere, you know, because people who don't speak English very well need to access all kinds of services. And, you know, medical care, the legal system are all things they're entitled to, and that right is protected by the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm. So how will you grow your organization? What's next? What's in the future for Found in Translation?
What's in the future? That's a great question. We're definitely facing a lot of pressure to expand. We're getting inquiries from around the world about, you know, can we teach them how to do this in Poland? Can we? Can they attend from Kenya by Skype? Can we bring this to another community? Do we have a model somebody could copy, replicate? And that's definitely in the plans, you know, trying to expand geographically a little bit, because Boston is not the only place in the U.S. and actually in the world that has lots of people who would make great medical interpreters who are being kept out of this profession just by socioeconomic barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing we really want to do is become a self-sustaining social enterprise. So one of the reasons that we haven't expanded is because we want to expand in a sustainable way, in a way that, you know, isn't dependent on grant funding that could be there one year but not another year. So actually what we're doing is we're not just training women as interpreters, but we're also creating jobs for them, and we're placing them in interpreter job placement that helps them to make money quickly, get them experience to qualify them for other jobs in interpreting that require prior experience, and it helps us to generate revenue as an organization.
Sounds so worthwhile, Maria Vertkin. Congratulations. I'm sure the award money will come in handy with your expansion plans. Also, what an honor to be one of the Grinnell Prize winners for Young Innovators in Social Justice. Before we go, you said at the beginning of our conversation, Maria Vertkin, that you're an immigrant yourself. I detect no accent whatsoever. Where are you from?
From Russia originally, and I spent my childhood in Israel before coming to the U.S. Oh. I was 11 when we came.
Maria Vertkin, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Are you an e-book reader, or would you rather have that good old-fashioned type of printed book in your hands? Well, some new information here, a new study. When it comes to textbooks, it turns out that the digital variety can provide more data to instructors wondering how well their students are learning. That's according to a new study by Ray Junko and a colleague at Iowa State University. Ray Junko joins us once again, an associate professor in Iowa State University's Department of Education. Hello, Ray.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you on once again. What did you look at here?
Well, we examined digital textbook use in a number of different courses, and we collected data that was collected unobtrusively by the digital textbook system, and we looked at two different things. There's something that the company that created this application calls the engagement index, which is supposed to be a measure of students' engagement with the text, which includes time spent reading, the number of times a student opens a book, the number of bookmarks they make, number of highlights and things like that. And then we also looked at the individual items that comprise that engagement index. And what we found was that one of those individual items, time spent reading, was actually an even stronger predictor of student grades in their class than the entire engagement score. So while the engagement score was predictive of students' final grades, the time they spent reading was even more predictive.
How can that you can arrive at that data that you actually know if someone with a electronic textbook is actually reading? I mean, they have the page open. You assume they're reading?
You do assume that they're reading. If they walk away, if there's a lag time, then the software will stop counting time. So I believe the lag time for this process was a few minutes.
Okay. What are the implications for this? With this, for you and other instructors at various levels?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we think about in higher ed is how we might help students be more successful. And we don't have very good ways to identify students who are struggling until it's too late. And so we often identify students who are struggling by their grades, their poor grades or poor attendance or something that we can measure. But often by the time we've measured it, you know, it's too late, especially in larger courses where there aren't that many evaluation points. Another way to identify students is by using background characteristics, and a very common one is previous academic performance. So we often use something like a high school GPA or an SAT score to categorize students into buckets of at risk or not at risk, and that's a very broad way to do it. It's also not a very good way to do it because anybody in a not at risk bucket can become at risk for, you know, a number of possible reasons. They don't understand the material. Mm-hmm. They're having some family issues. They might be dealing with psychological issues. They might be depressed. There's so many different things that can happen. And then conversely, people who are in an at risk category might not be at risk at all. And so one of the ways that we can identify people at risk is by using a system like this, which shows us through an actual real-time behavior how the student is doing. So mm-hmm. instead of me having to give an exam and seeing how my students score on it, I can actually look at textbook usage data in the first week and say, oh, well, look, here's this student who hasn't been reading, and we know from this predictive model that they're not going to do well, so I need to intervene in some way.
Okay. We've got to go now. Fascinating. I'm just trying to think forward how these textbooks will advance and how textbooks, the digital textbooks, will be watching us as students or watching future students. That's not beyond the realm of possibility. Is it watching your eyeballs read sentences?
That is not beyond the realm of possibility. We actually have eye tracking devices that we use in research, and if we wanted to implement them on a larger scale, I guess we could if people wanted to wear Google Glass. Does that even still exist? I don't know, but I think it's a bad, I think it's a bad fashion choice. Probably a good academic choice, really bad fashion choice.
Ray Hunko, thank you very much. Associate Professor of Iowa State University's Department of Education, a new study that looks at how digital textbooks can help instructors who are wondering how well their students are learning. Ray, always good to talk to you. Thanks.
Great to talk with you, Ben. Thanks.
Coming up in just a moment, Kyle Munson tells us about his ride along with a police officer who patrols not in a squad car, but on a bike, and how oats are not only good for fueling our bodies, it turns out also good for fuel for power plants. That's when we come back. It's River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're along. More and more people biking, sure seems so. More and more bike paths in our cities and towns. Cities and towns trying to make their communities more and more bike friendly. And what a beautiful day we have today. I bike to work most days. It's so beautiful when the sun's out and you have the crisp air like you have today. Also, bikes used for some types of work, delivery services. And there are also some communities in Iowa where police are doing their patrols on two wheels. And joining me now, Kyle Munson, intrepid Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Hey, Kyle, how you doing?
Hey, good, Ben. Great to be here today.
So you went to nearby Norwalk to go on patrol with one of their officers. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, I love to bicycle and try to get as many miles in as possible and every excuse to say that I'm working while I'm biking. And so, so the suburb of Norwalk, just on the south side of Des Moines, I caught wind of a new police chief there. And he secured a grant to get his cops for the first time in the department on bicycles. And so I wanted to ride. I had never done a ride-along. You know, you mm-hmm. talk about press ride-alongs in a squad car. I had never done a ride-along with a bicycle policeman. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. And there's a video of some of the happenings on the Des Moines Register website. But this is interesting because it raises all sorts of questions about how this works. How are you supposed to enforce law when you're just on a two-wheeler?
Right. You're kind of, it's not a, you know, it's a mismatch with a car, right? You
mm-hmm.
know, let alone a semi, anything else. Well, so Greg Staples, this police chief, he came from the mountains of Virginia. He's an avid bicyclist. And he, you know, if he's been here less than 2 years, but he, for this season, for the first time, got a few of his officers on bicycles. So the officers, they have a very sturdy bike. They have a pack. I mean, they carry everything from a taser to extra handcuffs to rubber gloves for medical emergencies, whatever. So they're as self-contained as possible on the bike. But, of course, you know, they don't have their laptop like they do in a police cruiser or something
right.
like that. So they're never the only officer on duty, obviously. That you can't be, you know, the lone officer in town, you know, and respond to every emergency. But I biked around with Brad Criswell, this officer who's been on the force there for years. And, you know, so he has a little set of flashing lights on his handlebars. So you do have, you know, the classic police cherries there. And he has a whistle. So, like, for instance, we did a little stakeout downtown in Norwalk in the main intersection where you have a four-way stop sign and a tiny little traffic light there. And so he stands there at the ready astride his bike, and he has the whistle in his mouth. And it's a nice enough day. Some people have their windows down, that kind of a thing. So there was a woman who didn't come to a stop. She rolled through the stop sign, and he blew his whistle and biked up along behind her and pulled her over.
Mm.
And so
it worked in this case. I guess as a driver, if I did such a thing, I would be afraid that I would wonder, what is behind me, a bike with flashing lights, and I might not pull over. But I suppose it's a matter of getting used to cops on bikes.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you're right. It takes a while for the culture to take hold. And you know, as the officer said, he was telling me, you know, it's with being a police officer on a bike, you have such a small window of opportunity to grab the driver's attention, you know, unlike in a car, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to let more drivers go when you're policing in that kind of a way. But they do this because the chief really believes in this, because they can be they're more immersed in their communities as they bicycle around.
Right. This is the opposite of an intimidating large patrol car. This is someone on a bike, after all.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in America we've had, especially in the last year, this huge discussion of, you know, the way police can be viewed in communities, or, you know, all sorts of discussions you can have about that. You know, and so you think of a police cruiser just slowly gliding down a street, and like all the assumptions somebody might make, like, who are they looking for? You know, where's the suspect? And whatever. But you see an officer on a bike, a lot of that just kind of evaporates, and it's a much different, you know, set of assumptions maybe. And so people like the chief in Norwalk think that this helps, you know, ingrain the police in the communities in a much softer way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can see everything, they can talk to people more easily, they can, you know, even smell things, whatever. There's been a rash of burglaries in Norwalk, and so they've actually had the bikes out at night, you know, trying to, you know, more easily kind of see and sneak up on potential suspects or burglaries. So, you know, they use them in a lot of different ways.
Now, we've recently had the unfortunate bicycle deaths in Des Moines, also bike-car collisions around the state,
mm-hmm.
Brought safety of bicyclists to the fore in our news. Can bicycle cops help on that front in any way, you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I was actually talking to the officer I rode along with about this, and, you know, and so, from their standpoint, they know that's a current debate, and they're kind of, you know, he was kind of on both sides of the issue. You know, you have to, I mean, I think the short answer is yes. Another, yet one more situation in which people see bikes as a valid, viable presence on the road can only help, I think.
Right.
So I think it does create one more step. You know,
right,
have,
right. And if you have my feeling about it as an avid biker as well is the more people you have who have the bike experience, you get to feel what it's like to be on our roads, many roads without bike paths or dedicated bike paths for sure. And if you are a car driver, don't you think, Kyle, who has never had the experience on a bike, you don't quite understand firsthand the challenges that a bicyclist has when, you know, your two-wheeler is there amidst all these 1-2-ton vehicles rolling by.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. So I think it just helps the culture step by step. And, you know, also Norwalk is a suburb about 10,000 people, and you know, it's almost the perfect size for this kind of you know, police presence on a bike. You know, it's not the city of Des Moines. You know, the cops on bikes is useful, but you know, I think for a town of this certain medium size, it's almost ideal to have officers circulating around this way, and so it might make the most difference there,
mm-hmm.
too.
Kyle, what, of course, naturally, you have the question, what about cases of hot pursuit? You can't very well chase a car if it wants to get away and you're on a bike.
That's right. Yeah, you'd think, yeah, the criminal has a big advantage, right? So, you know, as I said, the bicyclist, police on a bicycle is never the only one on duty. But the chief in Norwalk, Greg Staples, has actually been in this situation when he was in Virginia. So he said, you know, all you can do is you start pedaling fast, you call for backup, you hope the road is straight, and that's about all you can do. And so he did have this situation where he was pedaling furiously and just had to radio in the description, and then hopefully his colleagues catch the culprit in the car.
All right. Kyle, next week on Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe, Tom Moraine is going to be on. I'm asking you about this. Tom Moraine of Graceland University is going to be talking about a new project called Iowa 101, which I know you're involved with. To finish up here, tell us about the Des Moines Register's rollout of this program, which starts Sunday.
Yeah, this is a really unique. It's what historians or academics call a MOOC, a massive open online course. And so this is designed to be kind of the largest, you know, class on Iowa history ever. And Tom Rain's the perfect guy to do this. He's been a historian and a figure for years in Iowa. And so it'll be a great conversation, I think, next week. This is basically a look at what made Iowa the state it is. It's called Iowa 101. And Tom teaches at Graceland in Lamoni, and Des Moines Area Community College is a partner too, as well as Humanities Iowa. And then the Des Moines Register, we've stepped in to help provide a platform and for the class. So anybody can go online, come to DesMoinesRegister.com and participate, and it's free. It's not even behind our website paywall. And so now and through the end of the year, there are going to be regular readings and videos, and then people can discuss it on Facebook and through our Facebook chat on our website. So Tom will go through all that. And the way this launches is Tom poses the question, why did Iowa become the Hawkeye State? That's our nickname. It has nothing to do with the football team that we'll be playing again this weekend. But we are the Hawkeye State. How did that happen? So that's the first chapter. And then we go through this whole set of all these other chapters that Tom has put together in his curriculum, looking at why do we have the borders we have, and all these other interesting questions and some issues that we still argue about today. So that's what's happening.
Okay. Kyle Munson, nice talking with you again. Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too, Ben. See you on the trail.
All right. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some news items to send us into the weekend. Well, we know alternative forms of energy have received a lot of attention in recent years, but perhaps you weren't aware of one used in Iowa that uses a fuel possibly connected with what you might have had in your cereal bowl this morning. Let's find out more about a study that examined the practices at the power plant at the University of Iowa. At this plant, technicians have burned a mix of oat hulls, yes, oat hulls, and coal for more than a decade. And a new University of Iowa study shows that using oat hulls for power has considerable benefits to the environment and also to human health. Betsy Stone is with us, assistant professor in the chemistry department at the UI, corresponding author and principal investigator of the study, which is published in the journal Fuel. It's coming out in December, but it's available online now. Betsy Stone, Professor Stone, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
First of all, remind us, tell us, if we didn't already know, what has the University of Iowa been doing with oat hulls for more than a decade and why?
Well, the University of Iowa is committed to achieving a high fraction of renewable energy. In fact, we're aiming to use 40% renewable energy by the year 2020. And part of achieving that goal involves the use of biomass as fuel to power our campus.
Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that up the road from Iowa City, where you are, there is a huge Quaker Oats production facility, and they have waste product, these oat hulls?
Yes, the university is able to burn about 40,000 tons of oat hulls each year, offsetting the use of coal in the coal-fired power plant.
Okay, so you set out in this new study to do what, to answer what questions?
We were interested in examining how the emissions from the coal-fired power plant change when burning 100% coal compared to a mixture of coal and biomass. And in particular, we looked at a combination of 50% oat hulls and 50% coal.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found were very significant reductions in what we call criteria pollutants. That included reductions in fossil carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, which is an important precursor to acid rain, as well as very significant reductions in particulate matter that are important to cardiovascular and respiratory health.
Mm-hmm. So help us understand, though we're not chemists like you, we have some oat hulls and we have some coal, and let's say we have another pile of wood chips. How do they burn differently so that there's less residue?
Well, one of the main differences between these fuels is they have a very different energy density. Coal is quite energy dense, whereas the biomass is not so much. So we have to put in a lot of the biomass material to make up for the coal that we're taking out. Now, the chemical composition of these fuels are different. One of the main differences is that the oat hulls and wood contain quite a bit less sulfur, which means that we have less sulfur dioxide being formed, and we have to do less to then control the sulfur dioxide emissions. We also find that the oat hulls and wood chips can burn quite completely. They have a lot of oxygen already in them and volatile matter that helps that burn process go to completion, which means there's less unburned fuel coming out, and that reduces the amount of particulate matter in those emissions.
Mm-hmm. And so you found for the environment and for our air, for our health, an optimal mix between oat hulls and coal?
Well, this study was not really about optimizing the ratios of biomass. We were working at what we found to be the most oat hulls that we could get into the system. We were really looking at maximizing the use of that biomass and how that would impact these emissions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there drawbacks to using biomass as fuel?
There certainly are some challenges that have to be overcome. And a couple of those include having a reliable and local source of that biomass. And the university has been working on building partnerships with industry as well as local farmers to use sustainably grown and available biomass materials.
Mm-hmm.
Because of biomass having that low energy density, it can be difficult to get it into the boiler. So these boilers are really set up to burn coal, and so there have to be modifications made in order to get the biomass in. In addition, because of the different chemistry of the biomass, we have to sometimes take into account different operations for maintaining the boiler to avoid things like corrosion that can be driven by some of the metals that are present in the biomass.
Given the findings of this new study, what are the next steps for this type of renewable energy?
Well, we were really excited to see the significant reductions in criteria pollutants when burning oat hulls in particular, and so the next steps are to examine other locally sourced fuels like miscanthus grass and wood chips.
And are there huge sources of those that the University of Iowa can use?
There's a lot of potential for these fuels, and they are currently in the process of growing miscanthus that will be harvested this winter, and there are also a lot of sustainably harvested wood chips available from around the area, and so these are both fuels that have a lot of potential to be part of our renewable energy portfolio moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Going forward, from a chemist's perspective, Betsy Stone, what do you see as the biggest barriers to more and more of this more environmentally friendly energy production coming online?
Well, I think co-firing in particular has a lot of potential to help us transition towards non-carbon-based fuels. Ultimately, we want to get away from burning coal altogether, and biomass can help kind of transition us towards a more renewable energy portfolio. As we do that, we want to keep an eye on what that means for our local air quality, and so we'll continue to be doing emissions testing in collaboration with the power plant over the next couple of years to continue to keep an eye on things like emissions of particulate matter, metals, and some organic compounds that are known to be hazardous.
Okay, Betsy Stone, assistant professor in the chemistry department at the University of Iowa, corresponding author, principal investigator of a study published in the journal Fuel that's available online now, that shows using oat hulls for power, which they do at the University of Iowa power plant, has considerable benefits to the environment and also to our health. Betsy Stone, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we know that getting a dog can make a youngster blissfully happy. But for 17-year-old Tyler Gertz, a junior at West High School in Davenport, his pooch named Hugo, is much more than a pet. And together, that pair has made Iowa history. Tyler was born with a brain injury. He has autism, and he's the first student athlete to compete in cross-country with a service dog. This is a 2-year-old German Shepherd, was trained to be an autism service dog specifically for Tyler. He accompanies Tyler everywhere he goes, whether that's in the classroom or outdoors on running trails. Kelly Gertz is with us, the mother of Tyler Gertz. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. This is a fascinating story. Some people will not understand what service dogs do when they aren't serving those who have sight impairments, who are blind. How does Hugo help Tyler?
Well, Tyler has autism and the brain injury, and brain injuries are very, very unpredictable. You know, different symptoms can show up in different ways. Some of the things that Hugo is trained to do, he does deep pressure therapy, which when children with autism get anxious or overwhelmed, sometimes like a bear hug or something like that will calm them down, that deep pressure. And so Hugo is trained to, on command, lay it on Tyler and put all his weight on him, and that calms Tyler down. Tyler also cannot smell, so Hugo does tracking and trailing, he does detection work. So if there's smoke or propane or natural gas, Hugo will alert Tyler to that.
Okay, so you just said, I spoke over you, I'm sorry. Tyler doesn't have a sense of smell?
Correct.
Okay. So he's there to compensate for that, and he can signal Tyler. How long? So he's a 2-year-old German Shepherd, so he hasn't had Hugo very long.
Correct. Hugo just came to be a part of our family in April of this year, very end of April. So
I bet you they have quite a relationship.
Oh, they do. The bond when we went to meet Hugo was almost instant. We went down to North Carolina to meet him and ensure that there was going to be a good match for the two of them. And just in that 2-day visit to check that out, they created a bond. And since Hugo got here, they've been totally inseparable.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some videos of Tyler running with Hugo on the cross-country team there at West High School in Davenport. What is Hugo's function specifically during a cross-country run or training?
That's a good question. Hugo does not actually, you know, serve Tyler or help Tyler during that cross-country meet. He doesn't help Tyler run faster or anything like that. But running is an excellent way to bond, and it's very, very, very important to maintain the bond between the handler and the service dog at all times. So it's really important for them to be together all of the time.
I see.
And so it's just another opportunity for them to continue to be together and bond and develop that relationship.
When Hugo, this German Shepherd, was introduced into your son's life, were there any problems, challenges, any pushback to him having that service dog with him in school or on the cross-country team?
We did a lot of preparation work. Hugo came to us in April. We learned that he would be coming to us, though, last July. So we started right away before he actually came to us, after we knew that he was the dog that was chosen for Tyler. And during his training, before he came to us, we worked with the school in all aspects to integrate him into the classroom, into extracurricular activities and that type of thing. So we tried to stay ahead of the game, so to speak, in that. and make sure everything went smoothly. So when he did arrive, all the problems or issues or conflicts were dealt with prior to his arrival.
Mm-hmm. How does the team feel about Hugo, the dog?
You know what? This team is really like a family. The coach, Marty Leal, does an excellent job of instilling a lot of family values into these kids. And they take care of each other. They've always embraced Tyler and his situation. And when Hugo came, it was no difference. They really think it's neat. I think they're able to see how Hugo helps Tyler with his social skills and with his interactions with others and that type of thing. So I think it's something that's very natural for them to take a look at the situation and say, you know what, this is really cool, and they get to embrace it. So
Kelly Kurtz, congratulations on this success story. Put a smile on my face, and I know on a lot of listeners' faces listening across Iowa. Thanks, Kelly Kurtz.
Thank you.
Kelly's son, if you didn't hear at the beginning, has made some history, the first student-athlete to compete in cross-country with a service dog here in Iowa. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. On Monday, our sleep doctor will be here, Dr. Eric Dykin, to answer your questions about getting better sleep. That's on Monday on this edition of River to River.